It's 5:06. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert. Stay tuned. A little bit later on, we'll be finding out how to dispose of our old electronics responsibly and legally.
Plus, we'll take a look at the history of the snowmobile in our Wisconsin Legends segment.
For right now, though, we're going to be taking a look back at 2013. It was a turbulent year for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, or the WCIJ, as it continued to investigate stories pertaining to the state's environment, the wolf hunt, frac sand mining controversies, and more. It also found itself a target in a state committee's budget proposal.
While that proposal to ban the center from conducting business on UW property or work with anyone affiliated with the university was ultimately removed from the budget proposal, it put the center into the spotlight.
It did indeed, and the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism collaborates with Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television, among others. Here to talk more about the work of the WCIJ and its year in investigative reporting is Ron Seeley. He is an editor and reporter with the Center. And Ron, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be talking with you about the Center.
Yeah, I'd like to start out with a little bit of background, you know, because people who follow the media in any kind of form these days, around the country, you see centers like this sort of springing up. And you've been around for a couple of years. And for those people who might not follow the media that closely, tell me what is happening out there that is causing these centers to spring up, and what happened here in Wisconsin that led to the formation of the WCIJ?
Well, you bet. I think it's an important story to tell, and actually have been personally affected by this and some of the background here. I just left the Wisconsin State Journal in May. I was a science and environment reporter there for 35 years. And joined the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, run by an old friend and colleague of mine, Andy Hall, who started the center in 2009. And I think Andy had a lot of foresight in starting the center, and was really plugged into some of the things that were happening across the country with regard to journalism. As you mentioned, I think we're all familiar with what has happened to newspapers with the advent of the web, with advertising moving to the web and to Craigslist and other such features. And we really lost a tremendous amount of income in recent years because of that change. And newsrooms shrank, the State Journal's newsroom. Shrank. I doubt that there's a newsroom in the country that wasn't affected. Oftentimes, when the newsroom shrink and you lose resources, it is often some of the work that's done on major projects and investigations that suffers. Money is put into regular beat coverage, covering city council, of course, and school boards. But oftentimes, the important work of digging deep goes by the wayside. And I think that organizations like the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, which is a nonprofit, we're dependent on funding from private foundations. We don't take government funding. We're funded entirely by private foundations. I think they are now being viewed as a new model that will allow some of this important work to continue.
And you work in collaboration, so and by that I mean, you know, working for a newspaper or a television station 10 or 20 years ago, you'd work on your own stories, but the WCIJ tends to collaborate with organizations. You collaborate.
Yeah, it's been one of the most impressive things I've seen in my time with the center, and I think that's part of this model that's very important to understand. Newspaper reporting and the newspaper business has been, over the years, very competitive, going back years and years. It was the objective was to beat your competition to the punch with a story, to get the paper out on the street first. And what I think Andy understood as he started the center is that what was going to increase our power and increase our ability to do good journalism was to forge ties with other media outlets, for instance, with Wisconsin Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Television, which are very important partners with the center, but also other nonprofits like MennPost. We just came off an important collaboration on a story with MennPost comparing Minnesota and Wisconsin with regards to the new healthcare law. And that was done, as a project together with MennPost, even though they are a nonprofit trying to make their way just like we are. So those collaborations are crucial and a very important part and will continue to be a growing part of what we do and how we operate.
Let's take a look back at 2013 for the center right now. And stories and beats that you cover, you've got regular places that you cover?
Yeah, I, for example, just speaking from my own experience, I have a background as a science and environment reporter. One of my jobs at the Wisconsin State Journal was to cover the Department of Natural Resources. I continue to do that now for the center, cover environmental issues. We are very involved in trying to make ourselves a center for environmental journalism. That the environment beat is a good example of one of those beats that often falls by the wayside, or a science beat at major newspapers when budgets are cut. And as I don't need to tell you that there are just a multitude of important environmental stories out there that we're trying to keep track of, including the proposed taconite mine in northern Wisconsin, frac sand mining. We, the center, really became the lead news agency on frac sand mining in the last year, covered it in depth. There was an excellent report that was done in September by Allison Durer, one of our interns, who looked at the impact of silica on human health. Not many people had been doing that, and the DNR really has not really taken that up as an issue. And Allison did a good job of digging into that and finding families who are touched by these big sand operations and affected, by potential health issues. I think it's important to point out that the stories I've mentioned, many of our stories are done by our paid interns, and I think that's another thing that makes the center unique. We have a twofold mission, really, and that is to continue offering this important investigative journalism to media outlets across the Great Lakes region. But we also, as part of our mission, we have an agreement with the journalism department where we're housed to train journalists in these investigative skills. And our reports, we have a paid staff of interns. We're in the process of hiring interns now for our next cycle. And these interns do much of the journalism that you'll see on our webpage, WisconsinWatch.org. And it's professional quality journalism. These stories have run everywhere from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel to the Wisconsin State Journal, and of course on public radio and public television. So we're very proud of the role we play as not only investigative journalists, but educators and mentors.
We're going to take a break right now. When we return, we will resume our discussion about the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, and we'll talk about how the center found itself the target of headlines and the subject of headlines, I should say, and very much in the news itself during the past year. We're talking with Ron Seeley from the Center for Investigative Journalism. He is an editor and reporter there, and we hope you'll join the conversation too. Are you curious about their work? Do you think that the center does good work, or do you think that it is just carrying out an agenda of one kind or another? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us. That address is talk@WPR.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're talking with Ron Seeley of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and taking a look at the year that was and the year ahead for investigative reporting in the state.
And you're welcome to join in. If you have a question about the Center for Investigative Journalism and how it works, is there an issue you hope they would tackle in 2014? You can give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
And Ron Seeley, earlier we mentioned that the WCIJ turned out to be the target of a Joint Finance Committee budget proposal that would have removed your offices from the UW-Madison campus and would also have limited the center's ability to collaborate with anybody affiliated with the UW. That provision ultimately was removed from the budget before the governor signed it. But in the time since that proposal was made, have you figured out why the WCIJ was singled out as part of that budget process?
You know, that really has largely remained a mystery to us. It was one of those situations where the Joint Finance Committee was in one of those marathon sessions that ran into the early morning hours, and this particular proposal to basically boot the center out of its offices in the journalism department happened in the wee morning hours. And I know Andy Hall, our director, found out about it in a slew of emails and text messages at 5 in the morning. I think the story first appeared, a brief appeared on the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel webpage. But it not only would have removed us from the journalism department, would have also prevented the center from hiring UW employees. That was aimed largely at journalism faculty who collaborate and work with the center on training of journalists. So it was a shock and a surprise, but ended up being tremendously revealing of the support that the center, or the broad support the center has across throughout the upper Midwest and across the nation, really. There was a strong support from many quarters for the center, and eventually, of course, enough pressure was brought to bear that the governor vetoed that provision.
And, you know, during that whole discussion, one of the things that came up was the accusation that the center was a quote-unquote liberal organization. And, you know, when you hear that sort of thing with the journalistic background that you have, how do you respond to that, especially when you're responding to the same accusation sort of over and over and over again?
Yeah, I think all you have to do is really look at our record. We are nonpartisan. Our funding is very transparent. All you have to do is go on our webpage. You can see where our dollars come from. We don't hide anything about that. And if you look at some of the stories we've done, I think they speak for themselves. A good example is an investigation that one of our interns did of Wisconsin's GPS tracking of offenders. We found out that those tracking devices weren't working, actually, and people were wrongly being accused of being in violation, and some were threatened with being thrown back in prison. Well, the story caught the attention of Republican legislators. The Assembly Committee on Corrections called a legislative hearing to question the Department of Corrections about this, and at the hearing, one of the Republican legislators read aloud portions of the center's story when questioning the Department of Corrections director of sex offender programs, and really citing the center's reporting as a factor, the state legislature's budget committee, again made up mostly Republicans, scaled back a planned expansion of the GPS monitoring program, so and called for a study. So these are some of the very same people who, not much later than that, participated in this effort to kick us out of the journalism school. So I think that, again, our record speaks for itself, and we were interested in doing good journalism. And I think all you have to do is really look at the very top of our webpage. You'll see that it says that our goals are to protect the vulnerable, expose wrongdoing, and seek solutions. And we do that regardless of the politics involved. Most of our stories are really proud of, because they do get down to the street and where people live. They involve people's lives. We look at the problems that people are facing, try to write about them and come up with solutions. And everything from our stories and coverage of frac sand mining to stories, for instance, that we've done on job hunting help for residents with disabilities. We did a series that allowed those folks to get help faster. Governor Walker and the legislatures changed their position on some of those policies after that story ran. So you know, we're very proud of what we do.
I know another project collaboration that you're working on right now is the Wisconsin Water Watch project. Could you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'm personally very interested in that because of my work as an environmental reporter, and we're in the process of shaping those stories. I think a good example of the types of stories you're going to see is a recent story that just came out within the last 2 weeks by Kate Golden, a colleague of mine there who is also specializes in environmental reporting and does a lot of our work with data and data visualization. She found a really interesting connection between endocrine disruptors and the huge volumes of manure that the large industrial-sized farms are spreading now on Wisconsin farm fields. We're really interested in probing more at the issues of water, both the surface water, both groundwater and surface water, and the important connections, and how, despite Wisconsin being a water-rich state, we face a future where, without proper oversight and without some restraint on everyone's part, we are going to face a number of water problems. So we are collaborating with Wisconsin Public Radio, with Wisconsin Public Television, on a project. So we're excited about it.
And what's coming up next in the Water Watch series?
We're going to be looking probably following up on those stories on endocrine disruptors. We'll be taking a hard look at some of the industrial farms and some of the water issues there. We hope to take a look at the Great Lakes water issues, invasive aquatic invasive species. We're really hoping to look at some of the quantity issues, including the issues affecting places like Waukesha, where, of course, they're trying to become one of the first communities to take water from the Great Lakes and return it for their use. So there are no end of stories, water stories, and you'll be seeing a lot of them on our webpage, wisconsinwatch.org.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me there's no end of stories in general. So how do you pick the ones that you're going to be investing a significant amount of resources into? I mean, does it work a lot in the way that people think of a traditional newspaper or broadcast model might work editorially?
Well, it's tough. We are a small staff. We only have really 4.5 full-time professionals and our staff of interns. But we do an amazing amount of work for being small, so it's such a small organization. We also have a very extensive editing and fact-checking process that each of our projects has to go through so that they don't take time. But we aren't under the same time restrictions for daily breaking stories that a daily newspaper might be. We can spend a little more time on our projects. We do have to pick and choose, I think, turn out on Bill Leaders, and I haven't mentioned him, is our money and politics reporter and director of the money and politics part of our operation, and he does a weekly column, and those columns have been tremendously effective in keeping track of the issues, many issues regarding politics and money in our state. He does a column a week, and that column has been picked up and cited more than 470 times by at least 75 news organizations since he came aboard. The volume of material, the volume of journalism that comes out of this, I mean, people, they'd be shocked if they saw our offices. These are basically closet-sized offices in the journalism department. And for the volume of journalism that comes out of this organization, people would be shocked to see where we work from.
We've only got about a minute or so left. What can we look forward to hearing from the center in terms of news coverage in 2014?
Well, I think, the Wisconsin... the water watch stories are going to be very important, but we will continue digging into a number of important issues. I know Bill and I have been taking a harder look at the wolf hunt, which just ended, and you'll be seeing in the next couple of weeks some important stories from us on on that topic, and you'll be seeing a bill tackling issues such as redistricting, which is going to be a very hot topic in coming months, and we'll be on top of that story. We will be tackling any number of issues, and I really encourage people to take a look at the webpage to keep track of the webpage. There's also a very interesting long list of comments about our work from some of the people who use our journalism, the editors of small weekly newspapers across the state who rely on us for journalism that they can't do. And if you're interested in supporting us, there's a box you can check on, click on our webpage called Eye on Power. And we welcome your support.
All right. Terrific. Ron Seely, thanks so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
Ron Seely, an editor and reporter at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism.
I'm Rob Ferret with Gene Purcell. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickard. Coming up on Central Time, we'll explore the history of the snowmobile in our Wisconsin Legend segment.
But first, you might be wondering what to do with your old TV, computer, or other gadget now that Santa brought you a new one.
A new survey from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources shows that while many people are aware that you can't send your electronics to the landfill, few people know what to do with them instead.
Sarah Murray is the e-cycle coordinator for the DNR. She's here to tell us what we can do with our old gadgets. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So maybe a lot of people are clearing out space in the basement to put their old appliances or old gadgets while they figure out what to do with them. What can they do to get rid of those electronics in an environmentally friendly way?
Sure. Well, around the state, we have a number of collection points where people can drop off their electronics for recycling. We call it the eCycle Wisconsin program, and electronics manufacturers help fund the cost. So there's a network of close to 450 sites around the state.
And how can I find a site near me?
We keep a list on the DNR website. So if someone goes to the DNR website and searches for eCycle or just Googles eCycle Wisconsin, you can get to our page. And we keep a list organized by counties, so you can put in your county or maybe a neighboring county if you're right on the border and see what sites are available.
This is a fairly new program here in Wisconsin. What was the problem? Why is it bad if this stuff ends up in a landfill?
Right. Well, electronics are one of the fastest growing parts of our waste stream. You know, it's still not a huge amount compared to some of the other things we throw away, but if you just think about the number of electronics you have in your home, both working and ones you're not using, it's really grown over the last decade or so. And there's a couple problems with putting them in the landfill. One is that some electronics do contain materials that could be harmful if they got into the environment. We want to handle them properly, things like lead and mercury. And then there's also a lot of valuable materials that can be reused in electronics, so we don't want to waste them. We want to be able to recapture the plastics and metals and so forth and put them into new products.
So when we go to the site and hand over the goods, what happens after they leave? How do they get recycled?
Sure. So electronics collected through this program in Wisconsin go to a small set of registered recyclers. These recyclers have to meet certain environmental and worker safety standards. Most of the electronics in the program are initially disassembled in the upper Midwest, Wisconsin and our neighboring states, and a few others elsewhere in the U.S. So the recycler will take apart the electronics into the different components, and then they'll market those. So metals might go to, you know, local scrap metal yards or programs. Plastics might get sent overseas where they're getting made into new products. Some things like, say, circuit boards go to really specialized smelters that are able to extract small amounts of precious metals from them. So they really become commodities that can be used again.
Are there other programs that do this outside of this state e-cycling program? Are there stores or other agencies that are doing similar projects?
Yeah, so when I talk about eCycle Wisconsin, that's a program that electronics manufacturers help fund. So it often makes the cost a little bit lower. And as part of that program, we have a lot of retailers participating, like Best Buy, American TV, Staples, Office Depot. So a lot of electronics retailer stores will take those back. A lot of Goodwill stores participate in the program, and a number of communities and other, you know, waste haulers and other small for-profit businesses. So it's a real mix around the state of places you can take them. And then outside of the program, there are certainly some others collecting electronics, especially for some of the smaller devices that we tend to replace more quickly, like cell phones. There's a lot of reuse programs, too.
And there are have been some concerns. I think there was a 60 Minutes piece a couple of years ago. People worried that e-cycling isn't as environmentally sound as we'd hope, as we'd think. What you mentioned earlier, environmental regulations on the agencies doing this or the businesses doing this. What's in there to make sure that it's fairly environmentally friendly?
Right. So, you know, one thing we look at first is to make sure the initial recycler materials are going to is responsible, so that recycler is meeting federal worker safety standards, environmental standards, they have any permits they might need, and that they're really taking care to handle the materials properly and safely, and also protecting data security, which is another concern a lot of folks have. And then under the eCycle Wisconsin program, those recyclers have to keep track and let us know where they're sending the materials downstream. And so they have to do some due diligence to make sure they're sending them to responsible places. A number of recyclers also have third-party industry certifications now, which requires them to go through extensive auditing processes and really look carefully at where they're sending any of the materials from these electronics to make sure it's not just ending up in a dump somewhere.
I mentioned at the outset a survey from the DNR finding that a lot of people do want to recycle these things. They don't want to send them to the landfill, but they don't know what to do yet. Are you seeing rising awareness of the state's e-cycling program?
Yeah, so the program's been in effect since the beginning of 2010, and certainly since then we've seen awareness increase, but it's still not quite where we'd like. So, I mean, Wisconsinites have recycled a lot under the program. They've recycled close to 123 million pounds since January 2010, so that's a lot of electronics. And we know that there aren't that many people putting them in the trash. Really, it's more an issue of, you know, them being stored in our attics and basements and closets. So our survey found that while about 60% of folks are aware that they can't put them in the trash, there's also still a lot of people who aren't sure where to take them. And that might just be, you know, if you haven't decided to go recycle a TV, you might not have, you know, figured out where to take it. But we really want to make sure folks know that there are a number of opportunities, so you don't necessarily have to wait and hang on to them forever.
Do you have a target at the DNR for how big a success you want the e-cycling program to be?
I guess we look at it a couple ways. So each year, electronics manufacturers have a minimum target they have to meet of helping to pay for the recycling of a certain number of pounds, and that's been right around 30 million pounds a year. Now, there might be more electronics than that, so our main concern is making sure that folks do know where they can take the electronics and that they're not putting them in the trash each year.
And tell us again the website, the best way to find where we can take these things, and maybe we can start digging our attics and basements out a little?
Yeah, so just Googling the words eCycle Wisconsin or going to the DNR website, you can get to our website and find a list. Folks can also check with their local community, too. A lot of local communities might have more detailed information. But we keep that up-to-date list of all the permanent sites. And then especially, you know, if folks aren't quite ready to clean things out yet, as we head toward spring, the spring cleaning season, there'll be a lot of special collection events around the state, and especially in some of the more rural areas. Sometimes that's the best option. There'll be these collection events once or twice a year.
One of the longest lines I've been in was at one of these. It was a free bring whatever you got, your old gadgets, and I did exactly that. I hit my basement closets and my attic closets, those old circa 1990 computer supplies I had sitting around.
Yeah, some of these one-day collection events get a huge response, and so that's a great option. But, you know, if you're out, you know, redeeming gift cards or doing other post-holiday errands and you're happy to go by a Best Buy or a Goodwill or something, that's another option too, so you don't necessarily have to wait and sit in line at one of those events.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for your interest.
That's Sarah Murray. She's the eCycle Coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. By the way, we have a link to that website at wpr.org/centraltime, or you can go to the Central Time Facebook page to get a link to that information.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for our Wisconsin Legends segment, and today we're talking about not a person, but a thing, the snowmobile.
That's right. Believe it or not, the snowmobile was invented right here in Wisconsin. And here to explain how this machine came to be invented in the Badger State is Joseph Kapler. He is the curator for the Division of Museums and Historic Sites at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Joe, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
I want to start out with what happened before 1924, and we'll get to why that's an important date in a few seconds. So in 1924, cars were still were kind of popular in Wisconsin. There were roads of some kind, and you could drive around the state. We had lots and lots of snow, though. So what happened in the winter when people needed to get around in cars?
Well, if you didn't have a sleigh for your horse, or the snow was too deep for your horse, perhaps you were trekking it on foot in snowshoes. Or you simply didn't travel as much as you would when there wasn't all the snow, especially in the deep snow of the Northwoods.
And some people, though, would take their Model Ts and they would sort of put, I've seen some pictures of this, where they would put them on skis and sort of ride on top of the snow. And then in 1924, the story is that Carl Ellison hurt his foot and designed something totally different. So talk about kind of what he did that was so different, and then how that morphed into what we know as the snowmobile today.
Certainly. Carl was an avid hunter and fisher and trapper, and like a lot of his brothers and buddies, would out in the woods an awful lot and during the wintertime. And with a disabled foot, he really couldn't keep up. And kind of in his own words, he decided, if I can't join them, to beat them. And he thought of always tinkering with ways for better winter travel in the deep snow. And so he himself was flapping some skis on the front end of a Model T, and that could work again on established roads or trails. But that vehicle wasn't really nimble for in the timber, in the woods. And so what Carl's 1924 invention, where it stands out, is he made something solely created on its own. It wasn't an adaptation of an existing vehicle, and it was far more nimble to be able to get, not only on the trail, but off the trail and into the woods, especially if you're a trapper and checking trap lines and things like that, or a hunter especially. And so he took a little bit from here and a little bit from there. So pieces of a Johnson outboard motor, a radiator from a Model T, skis, rope, cobbled it together and made what he called the motor toboggan. And this is just a simple description.
And it's interesting, though, because you said it was nimble, and I've seen photos of it. And the original one still exists, right?
Certainly, and that's a great story. We a couple years ago at the Historical Society Museum, we did an exhibition on major Wisconsin innovations and trying to find that alpha artifact, right, the first
mm-hmm.
one.
Mm-hmm.
No one ever sits around in a lab and says, "Eureka, this is the great X or Y, and I should preserve this for some curator down the road." Things always get morphed or tossed out, but the original 1924, from which he received a patent a couple years later, exists. Virtually the same as it was then. And if you're up north, about 6 months a year, it's at the Vilas County Museum. The other time, it's at the Ellison's, their hardware and lumber store right there in Saner on display. So, as a curator, that is just wonderful that original is still around. You can, get right up to it and check it out.
And I have to say, though, that original one does not look very nimble.
Yes. It wouldn't be as with our 21st century understanding of snowmobiles as we know them, with their high performance. They look like they would be a little tippy, kind of a high center of balance there. Yet they could still, reach speeds that I would be scared to death on one of those. But considering what else the choices were at that time, that was a great step forward.
And it was a step forward, but, it did not stay in one place for long, right? I mean, as I understand it, he built a pretty successful company, took an order for 40 or so that wound up going to Finland or someplace like that, but worked very hard at improving them. What sorts of things was he doing to make those original motor toboggans more into what we know as a snowmobile today?
Yeah, I'd say he's first and foremost kind of a tinkerer and innovator. And so in his very small shop up there in Saner, he continually made about 15 or so of these machines. And so all hand-built, trying to reduce weight, trying to get a little better engine power, a little better traction, maybe a little bit on the underside to increase potential flotation
mm-hmm.
if you're going out over the ice. So tweaks here and there, a little more creature comfort, maybe even a windscreen, and then when so that was throughout the 1930s, And then as World War II production ramped up, I think he realized that he wouldn't, even if big orders came, he wouldn't have the capacity to fulfill them. And then he entered into a partnership with another Wisconsin company, Four Wheel Drive Corporation out of Clintonville, west of Green Bay, who had a greater production capacity. So he assigned his patents to them, and they had the production rights, and he received royalty. And so then from 1941 on to 1946, 47, all the production, they still branded them Elis and Motor Toboggans, but that was done out of the Clintonville facilities of Four Wheel Drive.
So back in those early days of snowmobile, you know, we all know who rides snowmobiles now. You put them on a trailer, you take them up north, you go out in the woods, and you have a good time. But these were not necessarily, these were not machines for recreation. These were machines for work.
A lot of the serious hunters and trappers, that's their wintertime livelihood. And you read some of the contemporary referrals, customer referrals, and people talking about how they can, you know, travel 120 miles of trap lines in a day. Unheard of, obviously, with foot on foot. So not only that, but then able to get supplies, medical supplies or food to remote areas, able to check things like power lines in the winter, which would be very susceptible to damage from snow and ice storms. So certainly probably considered more functional. And today, obviously, with our better roads and motor vehicles, the snowmobile is probably more, first and foremost, a recreational vehicle. But I don't think that was necessarily his intent from the beginning.
So when did that shift start to take place in Wisconsin, where you saw the snowmobile kind of evolve and from being just a workhorse, you know, kind of a tractor for the snow, if you will, into something that is used more for recreation, for racing, or for just going out on a trail and having a good time on the weekend?
In the late 1940s, Four Wheel Drive Corporation shifted their production to a Canadian facility, and yet they're still branded Elison, and they were ramping up size, multi-passenger, larger engines. You could, and then also marketing the speed aspect that you can really get out and fly on the snow, and there's a fun part of it, definitely. And then other makers, manufacturers entering the marketplace. And I think once you saw in the early 1960s when switching the engine from front to rear, and then providing most of the weight right over the traction on the back, and really be able to have high performance at speed, turning up and up hills, that type of thing, and the snowmobile, and more makers, and designing some just cool machines, cool looking machines with great names. Polaris was directly influenced by the last model of the Elison. And so you see all these things coming together. And so in the 1960s, the snow then primarily became called the snowmobile. That's a better marketing name than a motor toboggan. Sounds faster.
I'll give it that.
Sounds,
yeah.
Funner. More fun. And so about that time is when you see kind of the shift.
And some of those names that we all know, like Skidoo and Arctic Cat and Yamaha and so forth, is there any Elison name still associated with snowmobiling?
Certainly for the folks, you know, the collectors and the enthusiasts, there are Elison motor toboggans at museums around the country, not just here in Wisconsin. But the first is here in Wisconsin. Again, I think that's just fantastic. But there are numerous museums around, and they're highly collectible, those early models. They pop up every now and then. And then if you're up in Vilas County, hotbed of snowmobiling, you know, stop in for folks who know the name. You know, you can still go to the Elison hardware store there, like I said, and see not only the 1924 machine, but others as well. Kind of a little mini museum in there. And the Vilas County Museum, the time that it's open during the year, has an excellent collection of not just Elisons, but other other snowmobiles as well.
I know they do this a lot with vintage race cars and with vintage motorcycles and so forth, but in the winter, will they bring out some of these old vintage motor toboggans and start them up so people can get a real sense of what they looked like and what they sounded like and what they smelled like?
You know, that is a great question. I've seen some historical footage, but I haven't seen some contemporary temporary footage, and I do not know the answer to that. I would imagine that some folks who are collectors as well as tinkerers who have the ability, like any old technology, it's one thing to have it. It's another thing to be able to know how to operate it and keep it up and running and still remain vintage.
So are you surprised at the number of people in Wisconsin who don't realize that the snowmobile has its origins right here in the Badger State?
We learned a little bit about that when we did the Innovations Exhibition a few years ago. And this is one of those things where you mentioned the snowmobile was invented in Wisconsin. So, oh, well, yeah, sure, okay, that makes sense, of course. That seems logical. Yeah, maybe Wisconsin, maybe Minnesota, something like that. But I think for the most part, unless you're kind of an enthusiast, you wouldn't know the name Elisen. And so that's the types of stories that we try to get out there as well. It's certainly a significant story because snowmobiling is a major part of wintertime activity in North America. And so it's a major Wisconsin contribution. And maybe it's not so well known. And that's where we feel we can kind of shed light and give these stories a broader, higher platform.
Well, thanks for telling us about the snowmobile today.
You're very welcome. And folks are ever up north in Saner, it's a neat little stop there at the hardware and lumber store and to check out. Even if you don't like snowmobiles, if you like old equipment, it's pretty cool.
Sounds cool. Joe Kapler, curator for the Division of Museums and Historic Sites at the Wisconsin Historical Society.